It's nice to see so many people giving up a beautiful afternoon to come inside and watch some slides. My name is Don Ring, and I'm in the Department of Geology at Central Washington University in Ellensburg. The topic today is going to be the geology of the Columbia Basin, which is a part of the state of Washington, and I think something that most of you have either traveled through, whether you are aware of it or not, and certainly some of you that are from the state have had a chance to know a little bit or hear a little bit about it. You may not be terribly familiar with some of the aspects of the geology, and that's what I'll try and clarify. A word of comment. I normally don't have speech impediments, but my bicycle and I lost an altercation with a pickup about 5 weeks ago, and the result was a broken jaw and the loss of a number of my very precious teeth, and I got my jaw unwired the day before I came up here, so I'm still without my teeth. And although some of you are probably a little more familiar of being without teeth than I am, it's a new experience for me, so you're getting a little bit of the problems, at least, of talking without teeth. My philosophy in talking about the geology here at Holden has been to expose people to geology of the area, things that you have seen, can see, perhaps are familiar with. There are a lot of grandiose things we could talk about in geology, maybe that might have a little more worldwide impact, but on the other hand, I think it's important for people to know something about the areas that they're in. And without getting into a whole lot of complicated aspects of geology, this is what I'm going to try to do, is explain a little bit of the origin of the Columbia Plateau and some of the things that we see, mainly by using slides. If you have any questions as we go, please flag me down. Otherwise, I'll leave some time at the end of the comments and field any questions that you might have about what you've been looking at. So let's have a look at the Columbia Plateau. This is a geologic map of the state of Washington. The part of the Columbia Plateau that's in Washington, you can see in here, is primarily the region that shows up in yellow and has a sort of vein-like pattern through it. The veins are part of the what we call the channeled scablands, and that's a whole other story. But we're going to be looking mostly at this region here then through the very southeastern part of the state. Actually, the Columbia Plateau, or Columbia River basalts, as we're inclined to call them, cover this region in here that takes in much of the southern end of Washington, goes a little bit into northern Idaho and on down into Oregon. This is part of a very large volcanic region that goes clear on down into Oregon, into California, a little bit of Nevada, runs all the way across southern Idaho, and actually ends up at Yellowstone Park. All the rocks are not the same age and they're not of the same origin. It's a very complicated region, but basically it's a major volcanic occurrence. The Columbia River basalts proper, and the ones we're going to be looking mostly at, are, again, right in here. They take in Washington, Oregon, Idaho. Now, unlike our ordinary concept of volcanoes, these are volcanic rocks, but they're volcanic rocks that came out of cracks or fissures in the ground. They erupted something like the Hawaiian volcanoes. If you've seen, I'm sure everybody has seen pictures of the Hawaiian eruptions. Geologically, we look at those as being very mild, very quiet. The basalts are hot, they're very fluid. Our best guess is that they came up through these cracks in very large volumes and then just simply flowed away from the cracks that appear to have been mostly in this area along the Snake River, maybe a few miles upriver from the Tri-Cities area, which would be right down in here. From that point, they covered this entire plateau. In fact, some of them went all the way out to the coast. If you've been to the Oregon coast around Cannon Beach and Seaside and in there, some of those big rocks. It's, in fact, Haystack Rock is one of the bigger ones off the coast there. It's actually a rock that's made of the Columbia River basalt. So some of them did actually go all the way out here. So one has to imagine then that the surface was very flat and the lava simply came out in huge volumes. In a way, it's sort of like, I guess, pouring pancake batter on a griddle. If you pour in the same spot all the time, the materials will flow out around the edges and expand as far as they can until they hit some sort of an obstruction or something that would stop them. The area that we're talking about, the Columbia Basin, is also referred to as the Columbia Plateau. It's kind of a misnomer in a way because the two terms are a little bit contradictory, but the Columbia Basin in here is also a relatively high plateau. It's flat. If you've been across it, you're quite aware that traveling from, the Columbia River to Spokane, as an example, is not exactly one of the scenic wonders. You see a lot of relatively flat ground, and not only that, a lot of ground that doesn't even have any trees or much greenery to break up the monotony. So some of the people from the Midwest could certainly feel that Washington doesn't have anything on their country. It's a whole lot duller than traveling through cornfields and soybean fields and things like this. But it does extend on down again into the southern part of Oregon. So it's a relatively high flat surface, and yet it's a surface that also slopes gradually down to the south. It is a basin because if you poured a whole lot of water up here someplace, it would eventually run all the way down this way and on out. And so it really fills both concepts. This is the way we think the flows originated. This is part of what's called the Great Rift in southern Idaho. And you can see the crack running right along here, and it goes off into the background. And the lavas that are here then have just simply boiled up along that crack and spread out in either direction. Now, this is a very small-scale example of the Columbia River basalts, but basically the way we think they probably appeared. This is a region of much more recent activity than what we see in the Columbia Plateau, but it provides some inkling anyway of the pattern and the way. And again, you have to look at this and imagine that there was nothing like we normally think of as being volcanic or volcanoes. Very hot molten lava is just simply coming up along this crack and then spreading out in either direction, but nothing like Mount Rainier or anything of that sort appearing in the area at all. And again, in the Snake River Plain in Idaho, we find now that there are mile after mile after mile of this land area that's been covered with relatively fluid basaltic lavas that have come out of some of these cracks and fissures, and you can see how they spread out over the flat terrain. So this is basically the way that the Columbia River basalts actually formed. Looking at the Columbia River basalts in a way is like trying to read a book by the edge of the page. I tell people this, and it's kind of a difficult concept sometimes, but doing a lot of geology is the same way. The things we'd like to see are hidden underneath the first page or the second page or the third page, and what we get to see is the stuff that shows up around the edges. And it would be neat to be able to open the book up and read more of what's there, but what we usually see is something like this. We're looking at the edge of a basalt flow here, and that's all we see is the actual edge. And this is true, of most other geology. We look at the edge of the rock layers or only a small fraction of the layers. We don't get a chance to see what's really there. There is a dike here that was one of the feeders for the basaltic flows. It goes right up like this, and then you can see the dark stripe a little bit better going right up over the edge of the hill. They are hard to find. We really have not seen all that many of them. I think all in all there have been about 75 or 100 different feeder dikes found. It wasn't one single dike necessarily feeding every flow. There were probably multiple dikes, but because the exposures are so limited, why we've not been able to find a great number of them. So they do show up once in a while in different places. As you come up the Columbia, this is just north of Chelan. The dikes or the basaltic flows are resting on top of very much older rock. As you came, let's say, from Wenatchee to Chelan, you were driving through rock that was that looked like this. If you look across the river to the east, say if you're going back down the river and look way up on the skyline, this is the very top of the Columbia Plateau. And this dark layer up here consists of the very edge of the lava flows. Now, there's every indication that these flows probably pushed the Columbia River to where it is now, because the river makes an almost perfect outline of the Columbia River basalts. You do not find any basalts on, let's say, on our side of the river. When you go from Chelan south or Chelan north, until you get down to Wenatchee, you are driving with old rocks and rocks that are much older than these basalts on one side, and the basaltic rocks and some older rocks underneath on the other side. The river just makes a perfect outline of that pattern. In the eastern part of the state, there were apparently mountains, or at least some relatively rough terrain. This is a little landmark that's called Steptoe Butte. It looks like a volcano, but it's not. It's really a piece of very old rock. You might imagine it to be the top of a peak, and that peak has been completely surrounded then by the lava flows, so now it's poking out through those lava flows. In fact, it gives its name to any kind of feature that we find that looks like this world round is called now a steptoe. So the term steptoe just simply means an old mountain that has been or is surrounded by younger lava flows. The flows tend to be divided into two parts. The bottom part is what we call the colonnade, and this has the columnar structure that most of us tend to usually associate with basaltic flows. The upper part, and this is a flow that we're really looking at, just one single flow goes from here clear to the top of the slide. We call it the entablature. It's also columnar in structure, but the columns are very much smaller. They're just quite minuscule, and not nearly so well ordered, not so regular as what we see in the lower part of the flow. And so there's a very sharp, abrupt change in the pattern of the lavas. Most of the columns are five-sided, six-sided, seven-sided. They are not quite as neat as they look when you look at a colonnade like this, or a pattern of the columnar jointing. It looks like they're almost like they're crystals. They're not. Our best analogy, I guess, is to liken them to mud cracks. When you see a pond that's dried up and you see that kind of nice geometric pattern that forms when the sediment or the mud shrinks and dries and cracks, that's about the way we think these form also, that as the lavas cooled, they contracted or shrank, and the contractions then produced this somewhat neat geometric form. The sides are very irregular. Some are more regular than others, maybe more by happenstance than anything else. But generally, when you look at one single column, you'll find that it has maybe two or three fairly nice sides, and then a couple of three that aren't quite so neat, or they're shaped like triangles, or they'll have all kinds of odd shapes. So your eye picks up the fact that they look rather neat and uniform more than it picks up the fact that they are quite irregular. We don't have any real idea why they take some of the patterns they do. Here you can see some that are... Get that a little bit in focus here. Are quite large. You can see a man standing here. So these are probably 8 or 9 feet in diameter. Some go down to a few inches in diameter. It appears as though the size is dependent to a large degree on how rapidly they cool. The slower they cool, the larger the columns are likely to be. Some places, of course, if the flows are big, they're quite extensive. It's one of these kind of things that we have to do some speculating about, because we've never actually seen the columns in the process of forming, even though there are flows like this forming now in Hawaii, as an example. you can't go down and poke around in a cooling lava flow to see what it's doing. It'd be difficult work to start with, and secondly, if you did, you would mess up the cooling system anyway, and so what would happen would be that you would get some results that probably wouldn't tell you very much to begin with. So we just have to kind of speculate as to the origin of the flows. Some of the places we can see the flows fairly well, for instance, here on the Snake River, you can see the layer cake pattern. Again, we don't really know how many flows there are because the exposures are kind of limited. It's been kind of interesting in the last few years, well, say the last 3 or 4 years. The oil companies have started doing some work here, and I'll comment a little more about that later on. But the last well that was drilled, and we haven't gotten hard information yet because the wells are being drilled as what they call tight holes. In other words, they don't need to tell you anything. But we understand that they drilled through something over 12,000 feet of the basalts. Now, that means almost 2.5 miles of basaltic lava. So that's a pretty thick pile. And we have every reason to believe that that wasn't the thickest place that they could have drilled. So it looks like probably if they were to go, or somebody were to go to other parts of the plateau, where they'd probably find maybe as much as 3 miles of these things stacked on end. Here again, the dark patches that you see are the colonnades, the grassy slopes. The slopes that are a little bit more covered up are the entablatures, because the rocks there break down a little more quickly. So you can pick them out fairly easily as you go along areas like this, especially along the Columbia. Well, then we come to things like this that just kind of boggle the mind. Why the patterns show up as fan-shaped patterns, long swooping columns. They lie on edge, they stand upright. Normally we think of the columns as being upright. They tend to form at right angles to the cooling surface, so most of the time when you see the columns, they look like some of the other slides where the columns are standing vertically like bundles of fence posts or something. But then we find places like this periodically, and most of the time they occur in the places where the flows are extremely thick. But obviously something went haywire with the cooling system is the best thing we can say, and you do find complex fan-type patterns. These happen to be in Grand Coulee. But at this point in time, I don't think any of us have any really good, honest explanation for why they occur that way. We also find a lot of places where the flows have gone into bodies of water. And when they hit the water, they tend to roll up or ball up, and they make little spherical mounds of basalt that we call pillows. And so these are generally referred to as pillow lavas. The yellowish stuff in here is the weathered residue of some of the fragmented material that would form as the basalt hit the water. Most of you, again, have probably seen pictures of some of the Hawaiian eruptions where the lava is running into the water and there's quite a bit of boiling and steam and things like this. Well, the same thing would happen here, except this was fresh water, just a lake probably. And as the basalt hit that, why, there would be a lot of steam, a lot of fragmented pieces that would be thrown up in the air. And then along with this, the pillows. So you can get some idea, even here, about how thick the water, or how deep the water was, by the pattern of the pillows. Right up in here, the pattern changes, so it looks like that probably was somewhere near the depth of the water at this point. Some of them are a little bit different looking. Here is a collection of pillows where the surrounding material is a lot less yellowish, more rusty or a deeper color anyway. Doesn't change the pattern. I don't really know why. I suspect it's probably something to do with the chemistry of the flow itself. But at any rate, instead of being yellowish, it's much more of a reddish brown or reddish color. In the area, especially in the western part of the basin, you can see off in the skyline a lot of very white material. Looks almost like snow or flour or something like this piled on top of the of the basalt flows. This is a material we call diatomite. Diatoms are little plants that lived in freshwater lakes here. They live in saline lakes and other places. But when those plants die, their little skeletons accumulate, and ultimately they make a layer of material that would end up being diatomite. This is mined and sold as diatomaceous earth. It's used as filler material and things like this. But where they're mining it, again, you can see the layers of diatomite here. And on top of that is a lava flow. And on the bottom of the lava flow, again, is a layer of pillow material. So obviously the lake was here when this flow came along. And the flow has buried the diatomite, filled in the lake probably, and kind of terminated whatever activity was there. So we do find that there is a good sign that in a number of places activity went on rather extensively. And one of the best places to see this, perhaps, is at the Ginkgo Petrified Forest, which is a state park right along the Columbia at Vantage. Beautiful examples of petrified wood. The wood isn't especially pretty if you've been to the Petrified Forest area in Arizona. Why, this is pretty dull stuff because it's mostly gray and brown and white. But the petrified wood tends to form in the layers in between the flows, mostly associated with the pillow lavas, because the trees were washed in or floated in. They were in the lakes or probably some of the streams that were there. They were then buried by another lava flow, but they were also part of the mud and the sediment that was there, and so they were protected from being burned. And then over the years, the wood has been replaced by silica in a very faithful fashion. You can see the knot holes and the lines and things that were in the old wood. Most of it is driftwood. There is no bark to speak of. It's wood that's been partly floated in, but much of it was wood that probably grew in the immediate area. So it also tells us that during the time of the eruption of the flows, there were times when enough time transpired for trees to grow, plants, vegetation, even in a couple of odd cases, there are some signs of animals having been there. But certainly there was a lot of vegetation that appeared in between some of the individual lavas. The Petrified Forest, one of the gentlemen in the area has over the years dragged in a lot of trees. He lived around the river for a good many years, so he dragged in the trees and kind of made his own little forest here. The museum has, I think, something like 80 different kinds of trees that have been identified as part of the Petrified Forest, some going all the way from high alpine things down to trees that would have grown probably in a fairly subtropical climate, cypress and ginkgo trees and things of that nature that are no longer around. Was there a question? One other thing that's also common throughout most of the lava countries, and here I'll take Washington and Oregon and maybe other parts of the West too, but Washington and Oregon in particular are noted for agate. Now, the breakdown of rock materials tends to release what we call silica. The silica goes down in the ground along with the water, but if it encounters cavities like this, which are very common in the lava flows because the lavas often contain gases, and as they harden, those gas bubbles are trapped within the flows, and so it leaves a cavity or an opening. The silica then will be precipitated into the cavity, and it will start out perhaps as a lining like this. And over the years, then, it may gradually grow to fill in the cavity or partly fill in the cavity with silica. And if there is some kind of a colorizer, something to give it some color, then you may find various kinds of precious agate. So if you go to Dorothy's Rock Shop and do some lapidary work, this is one of the common reasons that we have so much of this stuff in our part of the country, is that we have the basaltic flows. We have a lot of ashy silica material that provides the source, and a lot of cavities just to put it into, and so agate is a big deal in our part of the country. You'll find agate shops almost everywhere, and a lot of varieties in some areas, because of peculiarities in that local area, will have some special kind of agate that has some unique color or some unique inclusion within it, or a lot of different varieties, but basically they all form the same way. It's also the same kind of thing that makes the petrified wood. The silica, in that case, just replaces the wood fiber very much on a point-for-point basis. So you dissolve the wood fiber and replace it with silica, and it's still the same kind of thing. This is dull stuff. This is not worth the powder it would take to blow it up, but it's a good example of at least the way we think the agate tends to form. In fairly recent times, the flows in the edge of the plateau, now out here in the main part of the Columbia Plateau, the flows are almost perfectly flat-lying. They're just like some of the pictures you've seen. It's just like a gigantic layer cake. It's just layer after layer after layer. But out in the western edge, and you can see some of the lines coming out here, the flows have been pushed up into, well, we'll call them wrinkles. They're just almost like you'd imagine taking a rug and pushing it up into a series of wrinkles. We call these wrinkles anticlines. And here you can see one of the anticlines along the Yakima River. The layers come up like this, they go across, and they come down in here. So it's a big upfold in the rock layers. Well, in the last few years, this is what the oil companies have gotten interested in, because anticlines traditionally are places where oil and gas can be found, and although this is not normally oil and gas country, there have been some indications in past years that there was at least some gas around, and so now the companies have come in, especially a Shell Oil Company, and started to drill rather extensively. Through most of the plateau, and especially so as you get in the eastern edge of the plateau, it's covered with a windblown soil. Again, this is not uncommon in parts of the Midwest. It's a little bit of a rarity in our part of the country, but this is loess, and it makes in what's known as the Palouse Hills country in the very eastern part of the state, well known for raising wheat. Very unusual terrain, because loess tends to be a soil that erodes rather easily, and it makes some rather unique landforms, and the wheat farmers there farm countries a lot of us would probably be afraid to hike in for fear you'd fall down and hurt yourself, and yet they drive tractors and combines and things around here with rather rare abandon. But this is kind of typical Palouse country terrain. You can see the fairly steep hillsides. They do have the good sense to leave a few of them alone, it does make a rather major deposit in the eastern part of the state. Loess has a very neat characteristic of standing in almost vertical road cuts. The old road builders, when they built roads through here, quickly found out that they didn't have to move as much dirt as the engineers said that they should, and they could cut through here with by just making the cut straight up and down. And there are a lot of the older roads where you'll see cuts just like this, where this is soil from top to bottom, and it's just standing there and has been standing there probably for as long as I am old, and maybe that's a long time. So the new road builders come along, and they didn't learn these lessons in the modern schools of engineering, so they'll slope them way back, and then they have all kinds of troubles with erosion and rilling and things like this. But the older cuts, if you travel through the back woods, well, you'll see this kind of cut fairly often. Along toward the end of the story, we find that North America was extensively glaciated by very large continental glaciers, glaciers that started up here in the, probably a couple of different places, but to a large degree here in the area around Hudson's Bay. And they did not start at the North Pole. If you had somebody say, this meant that it just simply got colder and colder and the North Pole and South Pole expanded, that's not true. In fact, you can see on here some arrows that show the flow patterns, and the flow patterns were from this region actually into Alaska, and you can see large areas of Alaska that were not even glaciated. Again, the glaciers were kind of like pancake batter. If you pour the pancake batter here, it's going to spread out in all directions, and that's very much what happened. So the ice expanded down into the United States from Canada and went, of course, down into parts of Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, pretty well down into the mid-continent. Those of you that are back there, for the most part, are farming the deposits from those glaciers. But as we go west, the ice began to run into barriers. The Rockies, the Cascades, things like this tended to pose some barriers for the ice flow. So the ice moved into the state here, but didn't go down nearly as far as it did out in the mid-continent, where there wasn't anything in particular to cause it to slow down. It came into the state of Washington in three different lobes, one that came down the Puget Sound about as far south as Olympia, one that came down the Okanagan Valley into the northern part of the Columbia Basin, another one that came down in the vicinity of Spokane, kind of in the very northern edge also of the Columbia Basin. But the one over here, what we call the Okanagan Lobe, did have some kind of interesting effects. It came down the Okanagan and then came as far down as, just past the end of Lake Chelan. Actually, just past the opening of Lake Chelan here, went across the plateau and then along about where Dry Coulee is, or Grand Coulee is, I should say. So it covered most of the northern part of the plateau here. And if you travel through there, you'll find some very interesting deposits, because the glaciers, when they stop for a while, will build very extensive ridges that we call moraines, and you'll find these moraines rather extensively through parts of the northern plateau. So here we're looking across some of the moraine. Now, this moraine is not like the moraine that some of you from the Midwest may be familiar with. This is very rocky stuff. You can see these black things here are not patches of brush or trees or anything else. These are rocks. And so our moraines are unlike those of the Midwestern area. And our dry climate has kept them rocky because the stuff hasn't broken down. So here we're looking to the south. This is the edge of the moraine. The glacier came from the bottom of the slide this way. Out here is the unglaciated terrain, and you can see the difference in the way it's farmed. The unglaciated areas are farmed almost down to the last square foot. In the moraines, the people that do farm them are very careful about how they do it. They move around and kind of farm around the rocks and rock piles. Hello. Everybody lie on their side for a moment. Rich is going to turn it over. Oops, we're going the wrong way here. We'll get back to it. There we go. Thanks, Rich. This is what the farmers up there call haystack rocks. This is a huge boulder that was carried in by the glacier. And when the ice melted, it was just simply dropped where it happened to be. And when you get up in the area of the northern Columbia Basin where these were deposited, you'll find literally thousands and thousands of these things. This is not a particularly the biggest one that's there. It's just one that happens to be handy to the road. And you can see by the two guys standing on the top what the scale is. So when they describe them as haystack rocks, they're really being moderately descriptive. So it makes the moraines up there anyway extremely rocky. The other thing the glacier did was to divert the Columbia River down through parts of the Columbia Basin. And the result was, at least in part, the formation of some very extended channelways that we now see as Grand Coulee and some of the features that are associated with Grand Coulee Dam. It also ultimately brought or helped in the formation of what we call the Channel Scablands, which is another whole story resulting from floodwaters that came from western Montana, but they also occurred while the river was being diverted by the glacier. And here we're looking down one of these channelways. Back in here is Dry Falls. This is actually through part of about the middle part of Grand Coulee, if you've been through there or ever intend to visit there. We also find places where there were tunnels running underneath the glacier. And as the ice melted, these tunnels were gradually filled up with sediment. So what you have is, it's like a stream channel, except it's a ridge or a pile that wanders along the surface. And you can see one of these going off in here. Now, this is not a little gully or anything. This is actually a pile of gravelly material standing on top of the surface. So you would imagine this as being in a tunnel that ran around underneath the glacier. And it makes a rather spectacular sight. There are some of these that go for 7 or 8 miles if you were to trace them along the upper flow areas. Here are some of the deposits just north of Chelan along the Columbia River. You can see in the background some of the layers, and as you drive along there, if you go north of Chelan a few miles, you'll see these deposits, as well as I said, literally hundreds and hundreds of the haystack rocks. Looking across the river, they look like bushes or something like that, but they're just simply huge boulders that are standing in there and that were dropped by the glacier as it gradually melted. And as I said last of all, the current thing of interest, at least geologically, is the drilling that's been done looking for oil and gas. Now, this well was drilled in the central part of one of the anticlinal folds. It may not look much like it here, but it was. They are now extensively testing the third well, and it may turn out to be a gas producer. It's certainly given enough interest anyway to cause some speculation, and it's a little hard to imagine oil fever occurring out in the Columbia Basin in Washington, but at this point in time, at least it's gas fever. I don't think they've found much in the way of oil, but they've certainly tested enough of it that I think they may eventually make a producer out of it. And if so, that would be certainly interesting to us.